leaders have told us that the war on terror may last 100 years. A new kind of war against a shadowy enemy that can never be defeated.
Either you are with us or you are with the terrorists.
Generation after generation will have to lay down its liberty in an endless war for global empire.
It was a breathtaking display of firepower.
And the Pentagon says, we ain't seen nothing yet.
The perfect specter to convince populations to relinquish their liberty in the name of security.
There is no doubt that Saddam Hussein now has weapons of mass destruction. There is no doubt that he is amassing them to use against our friends, against our allies, and against us.
And if he does not disarm, the United States of America will lead a coalition and disarm him in the name of peace.
We've been told that we're facing a 100-year war that will last generation after generation. In this film, we will explore who pulls the strings and who benefits from the dark spectacle of modern warfare. We will answer the question, do the people know how they are controlled? Do they understand the systems of power that surround them, the modern propaganda machines of public relations that wash their brains and fill their minds full of ball games and mindless fluff? Is the population beginning to realize that governments throughout history have used the specter of fear to drive their populations into acquiescing to total tyranny? September 11th, national ID cards, Big Brother, the Iraq War, the 7/7 bombings in London, the invasion of Iran, how are they all interconnected? In previous films, we have focused predominantly on September 11th as the foundational event, the pretext for the current geopolitical structure.
The smartest thing to do is pull it. And they made that decision to pull, and then we watched the building collapse.
National polls show that most Americans and Westerners believe the official story of 9/11 to be a fraud. And a large part of that majority believes that 9/11 was an inside job. But the establishment press continues to contest any alternative view concerning 9/11. In this documentary, we will first look at historical events that are not contested, events where the fact of government-sponsored terror is not debated, but in fact openly admitted to by Western governments. There are literally hundreds of examples of government-sponsored terrorism in modern history, or what are known as false flag operations. We're going to start by looking at just 5 past examples, then we'll look at several modern cases. What is a false flag? The encyclopedia definition reads, false flag operations are covert operations conducted by governments, corporations, or by other organizations which are designed to appear as if they were carried out by other entities. The name is derived from the military concept of flying false colors, that is, flying the flag of a country other than your own. There are many variants of false flag operations, but one of the most popular carried out by governments is to stage a terror attack or horrible criminal incident and then blame it on your political enemies. One of the best known cases of a false flag op was carried out by the newly elected Adolf Hitler on February 27, 1933. Nazi documents uncovered at the end of World War II, as well as testimony during the Nuremberg trials, reveal what many historians already suspected, that Hermann Göring had set fire to the Reichstag, the German parliament building. The Nazis then produced their patsy, Marinus van der Lubbe, an extremely mentally handicapped young man who was found rolling around in an alley behind the Reichstag, naked. Van der Lubbe was then taken before a Nazi show trial, found guilty, and sentenced to death. He was beheaded on January 10, 1934. Using the crisis he had created to pass laws similar to the USA Patriot Act, Hitler became dictator and set his sights on the world. By March of 1939, Hitler had already seized Czechoslovakia. Having gained both Austria and Czechoslovakia, Hitler desired to move east against Poland. but he did not want to look like the aggressor. Hitler needed an excuse for attacking Poland. It was Heinrich Himmler who came up with the plan. Thus, the operation was codenamed Operation Himmler. On the night of August 31st, 1939, the Germans took an unknown prisoner from one of the concentration camps, dressed him in a Polish uniform, took him to the town of Gliwice on the German-Polish border, and then shot him. The stage scene with the dead prisoner dressed in a Polish uniform was supposed to appear as a Polish attack against the German radio station. German radio, newspapers, and newsreels were flooded with images of what appeared to be a dead Polish soldier who had dared attack the Reich. Now Hitler had his excuse to invade Poland, and the nightmare of World War II had begun. In 1953, the Central Intelligence Agency, working in tandem with MI6, overthrew the democratically elected leader of Iran, Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh. Mossadegh had been educated in the West, was pro-America, and had driven communist forces out of the north of his country shortly after being elected in 1951. Mossadegh then nationalized the oil fields and denied British Petroleum a monopoly. The CIA's own history department at CIA.gov details how U.S. and British intelligence agents carried out terror attacks and then subsequently blamed them on Mossadegh. In the late 1990s, large sections of Operation Ajax were declassified. The field commander of Operation Ajax was none other than the grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, Kermit Roosevelt. Before his death in 2000, Roosevelt went public to the media, bragging about his patriotism and carrying out terror attacks in Iran and blaming it on the government. The provocations included propaganda, demonstrations, bribery, agents of influence, and false flag operations. They bombed the home of a prominent religious leader and blamed it on Mossadegh. They attacked mosques, machine gun crowds, and then handed out thousands of handbills claiming that Mossadegh had done it. The handbills read, "Up with Mossadegh, up with communism, down with Allah." Dr. Mohammad Mossadegh was incarcerated for the duration of his life. He fared better than many of his ministers, who were executed just days after the successful coup for crimes that MI6 and CIA had committed. The CIA then formed the dreaded Iranian Secret Police, or SEVAK, and a 25-year reign of terror and torture then commenced. The operation was seen by Western intelligence agencies as a huge success. The CIA then successfully used the exact same technique in scores of countries to overthrow elected governments and dictators alike. Operation Gladio is an umbrella name for literally hundreds of bombings carried out by Western intelligence agencies in NATO, in Italy, Western Europe, the Middle East, Latin America, and Asia. From 1947 until 1981, Italian presidents have gone public admitting Operation Gladio targeted innocent civilians and was to be blamed on leftists and communists. On November 22, 1990, the European Parliament had a resolution condemning the activities of Operation Gladio. The former Italian intelligence chief has come clean concerning Gladio's actions as well. Many other countries have declassified documents concerning Gladio. It is part of the public record that our government and other Western governments targeted trains, buses, schools. Several times, operatives zeroed in on school buses, knowing that images of dead children would get the population hopping mad and ready to relinquish their liberties. A particularly bloody bombing at the central station of Bologna, Italy, on the morning of August 2, 1980, which killed 85 people and wounded more than 200, caused some Italian officials to break their silence and begin to expose just a small part of this wicked operation. And now the Gulf of Tonkin incident. In the summer of 1964, President Lyndon Baines Johnson needed a pretext to commit the American people to the already expanding covert war in Southeast Asia.
Three communist PT boats attacked an American destroyer off the coast of Vietnam yesterday, and today President Johnson's response was hard and tough.
To any armed attack upon our forces, we shall reply. To any in Southeast Asia who ask our help in defending their freedom, we shall give it.
In November of 2001, the LBJ Presidential Library and Museum released tapes of phone conversations with the President and then Defense Secretary Robert McNamara, where they openly discussed plans to use the staged Gulf of Tonkin incident as a pretext to expand the war. Then, in late 2005, the National Security Agency declassified its own official history of the Gulf of Tonkin and admitted that intelligence agency officers had deliberately skewed the intelligence and claimed that Vietnamese patrol boats had attacked U.S. destroyers on August 4, 1964, when in reality they had done nothing, even while being fired on by U.S. forces. Congress then authorized the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution, the Tonkin Lie, paved the way for 58,000 American deaths and over 1.5 million dead Vietnamese. On October 6, 1976, two time bombs made of C-4 planted on a Douglas DC-8 aircraft exploded, killing all 73 people on board in the most deadly act of airline terrorism in the Western Hemisphere until September 11, 2001. The plane was carrying Olympic athletes from three countries, including gold medal winners from Cuba. Declassified FBI and CIA documents show that the convicted bombers of the flight had been given U.S. visas just days before the attack and that they were in the employ of the U.S. government. This had been reported on in respected publications for years, but has now been confirmed by multiple declassifications. Cuban plane bomber was CIA agent. Declassified U.S. government documents show that a man suspected of involvement in the bombing of a Cuban passenger plane worked for the CIA. Luis Posada Carrillas. In the early 1960s, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, L.O. Lemonser, concocted a plan for false flag operations as a pretext to invade Cuba and for war with the Soviet Union. In Operation Northwoods, they planned to hijack jets by remote control, crash them, and blame the attack on Cuba. There were many other terrorist attacks they planned to carry out that were contained within the document. One scenario mentioned was the destruction of a U.S. naval vessel that was to be blamed on a foreign power as a pretext for war with any enemy they picked. President Lyndon Baines Johnson went operational with Northwoods on June 8, 1967 during the Six-Day War. During the Six-Day War between Israel and the Arab nations, the USS Liberty was sent by Johnson to collect electronic intelligence in the Eastern Mediterranean. The clearly marked U.S. intelligence ship was 14 miles off the coast of Israel in international waters.
A short time after the air attack had been completed, the three torpedo boats approached us from our starboard quarter at high speed and in an apparent torpedo launch attitude.
Israeli surveillance aircraft flew low over the ship and clearly identified it as an American vessel. At 2 p.m. that afternoon, the USS Liberty was attacked by three Mirage III fighter bombers. From the onset of the attack, the fighter bombers were jamming U.S. signals. Not only were they jamming U.S. signals specifically, they were also unmarked, the only unmarked aircraft in Israel's arsenal. The fighter bombers strafed the ships with their cannons, dropped conventional munitions and napalm on the ship, repeatedly from stem to stern. After the Mirages had done their work, the ship was hit by medium bomber Dassault Missiles carrying napalm and other munitions like white phosphorus. The USS Liberty was then attacked by three Israeli torpedo boats bearing Israeli flags. The torpedo gunboats opened fire with high-caliber machine guns and launched torpedoes. A single torpedo struck the ship, blowing a hole in both sides, entering the ship and leaving a 30-foot exit hole when it exploded. Then the torpedo boats began strafing life rafts in the water, an international war crime. While all of this was happening, the oversized American flag flew clearly above the ship. The attack on the Liberty went on for hour after hour after hour. During the entire attack, the USS Liberty continually called the Sixth Fleet that was nearby, begging for air support or rescue. Two aircraft carriers in the Med responded by launching fighter aircraft. Unbelievably, they were recalled by the White House. Rear Admiral Geist, then commanding the carriers in the Sixth Fleet, called Washington personally to confirm the recall order. Secretary of Defense McNamara came on the line, and then President Johnson himself told Geis, "I want that goddamn ship going to the bottom. No help. Recall the wings." Imagine being Admiral Geis begging the president to allow you to defend an American ship that's under attack, and being told by him that he wants the ship going to the bottom. Despite the fact that the U.S. carriers withdrew their help, a Russian spy ship appeared and witnessed part of the attack. After 3 hours into the attack, the Israelis withdrew because there were witnesses, allowing the damaged USS Liberty to limp to safety. 40 years after the attack on the USS Liberty, we know exactly what happened. I've interviewed former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Thomas Moore. I've interviewed the admirals that were on the line who heard what President Johnson said. I've even talked to the head JAG officer of the Navy, who was ordered to falsify the reports and cover up what had really happened. One of the Israeli pilots has gone public as well, saying that three times he refused over his radio to headquarters to attack the ship, saying clearly that it was an American ship in international waters and an ally. He was ordered under threat of court-martial to engage the ship. In a nutshell, this is what happened. President Johnson had personal control over the ship, parked it in the Mediterranean, made a backroom deal with Israel to attack it with an order to kill all aboard. Then the attack on the ship was to be blamed on Egypt. The U.S. would enter the war and take over the entire Middle East. In the aftermath of the attack on the most highly decorated ship in U.S. history, the captain and his entire crew were told they would spend life in prison or be killed if they told anyone what happened. Captain William L. McGonagall was given the Congressional Medal of Honor in secret and told not to tell anyone that he had won the award. Now that we've looked at a small cross-section of historical examples of government-sponsored terrorism, let's fast forward to the horrific attacks of 7/7 in London. Prime Minister Tony Blair, leader of the Labour Party, was facing an uphill battle in parliamentary elections. National polls showed that his pro-war party was sure to lose. And then right on time, the bombings of 7/7 and 7/21 occurred. Within days of the London bombings, evidence began to emerge indicating Western Intelligence Agency involvement. I traveled to London from Austin, Texas, to personally investigate. Once I arrived, I was met by Paul Joseph Watson and his brother Steve Watson, who are reporters for my news website, PrisonPlanet.com. To understand the London bombers and who perpetrated them, you first need to look at 3/11, 2004, the bombings in Madrid, Spain. Years after the blast that rocked trains in the city of Madrid, Spain, the government admits that Al-Qaeda had no connection to the attacks. Every one of the supposed bombers had intimate links to the Spanish security services, including the head of their bomb squad. The alleged leader of the bombers, who reportedly gave dynamite to the terrorists, was connected to the Madrid bomb squad. And we see the exact same earmarks, the same MO in the London bombings that we witnessed in Madrid. On the morning of July 7th, 2005, three trains and a city bus were ripped to pieces when four military-grade explosive devices detonated. At 8:50 a.m., three explosive devices simultaneously detonated on three separate trains. Within minutes, eyewitnesses were reporting to the press that there had been multiple terror attacks. Despite the fact that three train cars were burning wrecks strewn with dead and dying Londoners, Scotland Yard, for over an hour and a half, claimed that all of the disruptions were simply caused by a power outage in the London Underground.
Power surge on the Underground. That's a weird... the bus was about an hour after the Underground, so that's when I think everybody knew that it wasn't what it was, you know. I think it was just an excuse, power surge, whatever.
Why would they say that, though, knowing it was?
Trying to cover up, probably, you know what I mean? So there wasn't no panic and everybody sort of like, just get on with everything, you know, so...
Then, mysteriously, 50 minutes into the attack, the London Police Department orders the number 30 Hackney to Marble Arch bus to leave its normal route and to park at the corner of Woburn Square and Tavistock Place. At 9:47, a fourth bomb detonates, killing 13 civilians and injuring many others. Note, out of several hundred buses in service that morning, it's the only bus that the police take special control of and direct to Tavistock Square.
I've been walking up and down this road, looking at the bus stops for a number 30. The bus stops have all the numbers of the buses on them individually. There's no number 30 on any of the bus stops. That's because the number 30 bus was specifically rerouted here on that day.
To simplify it, there's no bus stop here.
There's no number 30 bus stop here, no.
Well, that was in the news, that it was specifically diverted here.
They admitted that the number 30 bus was the only bus that was directed to a different area of the city. For what reason? Nobody knows, but they admit that. So it's very strange that, for no reason, it would come down this road when it was bombed.
Remember, while all this is happening, the police are on radio and TV telling everyone that it's just a power failure, an outage. Meanwhile, commuters on the bus were listening to other radio reports where eyewitnesses were reporting explosions. The supposed bomber on the bus with the rucksack became panicked and began looking in his rucksack in what witnesses said was a confused and frightened manner. Weeks later, police detectives investigating the case said that all four of the bombers on the three trains and the bus didn't fit the MO, the modus operandi, of bombers. They bought two-way tickets. They'd played games of cricket the night before. They had good jobs and happy families. One of the alleged bombers was caught by surveillance camera arguing with the ticket clerk about the price of his pass. After Scotland Yard detectives had a chance to talk to some of the eyewitnesses from the bus and the trains, they stated clearly on the record that they believed that the bombers did not know that they had explosives in their backpacks. This was only one of many huge developments in the case that only received bare mentions in the back of the newspaper. The July 29th edition of Fox News Channel's Dayside program revealed that the so-called mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, Harun Rashid Aswad, is a British intelligence asset. Former Justice Department prosecutor and FBI terror expert John Loftus exposed the fact that Aswat was being protected by MI6 and was clearly under their control.
Aswat is believed to be the mastermind of all the bombings in London from on the 7/7 and 7/21. This is the guy, we think. This is the guy, and what's really embarrassing is that the entire British police are out chasing him, and one wing of the British government, MI6, or the British Secret Service,
right,
has been hiding him. And this has been a real source of contention between CIA,
hold on, John,
Justice Department, and Britain.
MI6 has been hiding him. Are you saying that he has been working for them?
Oh, I'm not saying it. This is what the Muslim sheikh said in an interview in a British newspaper back in 2001.
So he's a double agent, or what?
He's a double agent.
He's working for the Brits to try to give them information about Al-Qaeda, but in reality, he's still an Al-Qaeda operative.
Yeah. The CIA and the Israelis all accused MI6 of letting all these terrorists live in London. Now, we knew about this guy Aswat. Back in 1999, he came to America. The Justice Department wanted to indict him in Seattle because him and his buddy were trying to set up a terrorist training school in Oregon. The headquarters of the U.S. Justice Department ordered the Seattle prosecutors not to touch Aswat.
Hello. Now, hold on. Why?
And that's, well, apparently Aswat was working for British intelligence. Now, there's a split of opinion within U.S. intelligence. Some people say that the British intelligence fibbed to us. They told us that Aswat was dead, and that's why the New York group dropped the case. That's not what most of the Justice Department thinks. They think that it was just, again, covering up for this very publicly affiliated guy with Al-Mujarrab. He was a British intelligence plant.
Our CIA says, okay, let's arrest him, but the Brits say no again?
The Brits say no. Now, at this point, 2 weeks ago, the Brits know that the CIA wants to get a hold of Haroon. So what happens? He takes off again, goes right to London. He isn't arrested when he lands. He isn't arrested when he leaves.
Even though he's on a watch list.
He's on a watch list. The only reason he could get away with that was if he was working for British intelligence. He was a wanted man.
And then takes off the day before the bombings, I understand it?
Yeah, and goes to Pakistan. Pakistanis arrest
him. They jail him.
They jail him. He's released within 24 hours.
In London, we spoke with David Shaler, a former MI5 agent who was convicted of breaking the Official Secrets Act and imprisoned for 6 months.
With regard to 7-7, there has been a witness report now included in a local British newspaper called the Cambridge Evening News, in which somebody who was on one of the tube trains says that he didn't see a man with a rucksack. In fact, after the explosion, what he saw was metal pointing upward from the bottom of the carriage. That would indicate, of course, that the bomb was not carried onto the tube train, but was in fact attached underneath it. Now again, nobody in the British national press is following that up. Now I hope investigators and the police are.
A current member of British Parliament and a former cabinet minister in Prime Minister Tony Blair's government, Michael Meacher was sacked in 2003 for raising important questions on the eve of the Iraq war.
Atrocity of London bombings, where 56 people were killed. That was on the 7th of July, 7-7 we call it. It's a very convenient way of ensuring there is fear, of ensuring that there is control, and of ensuring that those who are in the know, and of course we cannot tell you because it is all secret, are in a position of extreme power.
As part of our inquiry into the London bombing, we wanted to investigate the suspicious death of Jean-Charles de Mendez. Within days of his brutal murder at the Stockwell tube station in the London Underground, evidence of a cover-up began to emerge.
What did you witness with the unfortunate Brazilian man that died?
All we saw was the police running into the station with guns. That's all we saw. We didn't see anything else at all. And then a couple of seconds after that, we were vacated down South Lambeth Road. That was all we saw. We didn't see anything else.
I mean, are you sad for him and his family that he's dead?
Oh, yeah, but at the end of the day, he should have stopped and surrendered, shouldn't he? If it's happened in his own country, he would have been shot down as well. So with all that's gone on, the police were only doing what they thought was best, as far as I'm concerned.
Why do you think he ran?
Well, because his visa had run out, obviously. But he's not going to have armed police running after him just because his visa's run out, has he? So the police were protecting, you know, the people travelling on the tube, so I don't see any wrong in what the police have done at all.
No, I understand your view on that. Why do you think they shot him 8 times in the head?
I don't know. It's a lot of times to shoot him. It is a lot of times to shoot him.
How many times did you hear they shot him?
Five at first. Five, and then, no, three first, then five, then it went up to eight. So.
And the police admit they tackled him and then shot him.
Well, they told him to surrender, didn't they? They told him to stop, and he didn't. He carried on running, so, you know. What else could they have done, as far as I'm concerned?
007, huh?
007.
License to kill.
Yeah. I still believe that there should be a shoot-to-kill policy. I still believe, personally. But that's my views, you know. I think people should give up their liberty for freedom.
All right.
London police were later forced to admit that Mr. Domínguez never ran from them, wasn't wearing a heavy coat, and that a special army unit had killed him execution style with over 10 shots to the head at point-blank range. The British government was so desperate to keep the details of the shooting secret that they went so far as to arrest an ITN television journalist who had simply gotten a copy of what would normally be a public police report. Government whistleblowers and police have also been suspended and arrested for telling the truth. We had our details taken and were threatened with arrest simply for asking questions of locals outside the Stockwell station and videotaping police.
Where are you based?
Austin, Texas.
Alex, what's your date, bro?
2-11-74. Would you just rather see my grandpa?
No, that's okay.
Well, here, just let me do it. Take it down.
That's all I need, mate.
Well, I mean...
And you're just, you're filming for a program back in the States or something?
Exactly. In fact, I think it'll probably be broken into... It'll probably be broken into...
Think about it.
Yeah. Sir, what do you think about this event?
I think it's very bad this has happened.
What do you think should happen?
I think the policy of shooting should have been more thoroughly thought out. I'm afraid there must have been a terrible mistake here.
I feel very sorry for the family and very sorry for the policeman that made a horrible mistake.
Yeah, it's going to be bad for everybody.
It's a tragedy all around, I think.
Thank you.
The police first claimed that it was a hot morning when official weather reports showed that it was around 60 degrees and that Mr. Domínguez was running down the street wearing a giant padded coat with wires sticking out of it, that he vaulted over the turnstiles, charged through a crowd of pedestrians, raced onto the train, and was about to detonate bombs when the heroic officers gunned him down. The authorities then conveniently claimed that all the surveillance cameras malfunctioned that morning. Police have now been forced to admit, thanks to watchdogs in their ranks, that none of the cameras malfunctioned, and they've now released the video. The government has now been forced to admit that he was wearing a light denim jacket, and there were no wires of any type. Police that weren't part of the special military unit didn't know why they killed him. The police had followed him from his home. They knew that he was a Latin Brazilian working in England as an electrician. They followed him for 30 minutes as he walked from his home towards the station. Once in the station, he calmly bought a Metro paper, paid for his ticket with his Metro Oyster card, and then walked onto the train. Passengers then reported that they were told to get off the train. Once they'd stepped off, still looking through the windows, they saw the Special Forces police squat on Mr. Domínguez and shoot him over 10 times in the head. Witnesses said Domínguez looked at the authorities as if he knew them. He was like a scared rabbit, and he was killed execution style. The question is why. A special military hit team stalked him and tracked him from his home to the train station, and then killed him in cold blood, making sure he was dead. It's well known that if somebody has a bomb, you don't shoot at them, and you certainly don't get near them. No, Mr. Domínguez had seen something he wasn't supposed to see. He learned a little too much, and he had to be eliminated. We were at the station just a week after he was killed, and many of the facts we've covered were already public knowledge. But still, some of the locals made excuses for the police. Within hours of the 7/7 bombings, Israeli Army Radio was reporting that Benjamin Netanyahu, the former Prime Minister of Israel, had been warned not to leave his hotel that morning to attend a meeting less than 100 yards away from one of the train stations that was bombed. The Associated Press ran the headline, Netanyahu changed plans due to warning. Then the current Prime Minister, Ariel Sharon's office, instructed Israeli officials not to give interviews to the foreign media concerning the warning. Israel's foreign office attempted to spin the story, saying that they'd given a general warning to the British that day. Then several weeks later, the head of Mossad told a major German newspaper that he indeed had issued a warning to Benjamin Netanyahu at 8:40 a.m., 10 minutes before the first blast. Conveniently for authorities, the bus surveillance camera malfunctioned. Something else happened that was convenient for the establishment line. All four of the supposed bombers' identification cards survived unscathed at all four events. But there was just one problem. In one case, one of the bombers' IDs was found at two separate locations. As the evidence mounts, it is crystal clear. Only criminal elements of the British government could stage the attacks and then engage in the cover-up. The reason the Netanyahu story is important is it clearly shows that other intelligence agencies were aware of what was going on in London that day and took necessary precautions to protect their Minister of Finance.
In 1994, the Israeli embassy in London was bombed. This was at a time when I was in the service. I joined the Middle Eastern section shortly after that. And I was actually astounded to read a document written by a senior MI5 officer who'd seen all the information coming in about this attack. And he said that he believed that the Israelis had bombed their own embassy.
In any staged terror attack, governments have to be extremely careful to keep the operation shielded, compartmentalized. Most people in government are moral individuals who believe that they're standing up for their nation's sovereignty, for its national interest, and it's absolutely essential to keep them in the dark. One of the chief tools used by governments as a smokescreen is staging exercises or drills at the exact same time and exact same places as real events. When the Oklahoma City Federal Building was bombed, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms was staging an anti-terror drill with their bomb squad on the morning of April 19, 1995, at the same time that the real event took place. On the morning of September 11, 2001, the Pentagon was running five separate drills, two of the drills targeting the exact same targets at the exact same time. That caused NORAD to stand down, believing it was just a drill. And London was no different. It's important to note that those taking part in the drills need not know that they're part of a larger operation. In fact, it's better for the conspirators that they not be informed. One of the chief reasons this is done is so that if any of the operatives carrying out the attack are caught by other elements of the government, they can simply claim that they were taking part in a drill or an exercise. NSA, InfoPol 9, and Echelon-type systems that are scanning for terrorist chatter will be fooled into believing they've simply picked up part of an exercise. On the morning of 7-7 in London, there was a simultaneous exercise targeting the exact same trains, the exact same bus, at the exact same locations, at the very same time.
What we're supposed to believe is some kind of coincidence. There was also an anti-terrorist drill going on 7-7. And again, just like 9-11, they were talking about attacks on the same targets, the same kind of tube stations, and exactly the same time as the actual attack happened.
We learned of the drills of 7-7 on 7-7 from Peter Power, the head of Visor Consultants, a crisis management firm based in London. Mr. Power was the former spokesperson for Scotland Yard. Mr. Power told National British Television, ITN News, about the drills.
Today we were running an exercise for a company, bearing in mind I'm now in the private sector, and we sat everybody down in the city, 1,000 people involved in the whole organisation, but the crisis team, and the most peculiar thing was we based our scenario on the simultaneous attacks on the underground and mainline station. So we had to suddenly switch an exercise from fictional to real. And one of the first things is, get that bureau number, when you have a list of people missing, tell them. And it took a long time.
Just to get this right, you were actually working today on an exercise that envisioned virtually this scenario?
Almost precisely. I was up until 2 o'clock this morning because it's our job, my own company, Visor Consultants. We specialise in helping people to get their crisis management response. How do you jump from slow time thinking to quick time doing? And we chose a scenario with their assistance which is based on a terrorist attack because they're very close to a property occupied by Jewish businessmen. They're in the city, and there are more American banks in the city than there are in the whole of New York. A logical thing to do. And
how extraordinary today must feel for you as it unfolds.
He repeated himself to BBC Radio 5.
The thing that concerns me is that what are we doing for the thousands of men and women actually who are in London working? And I say that because at 9:30 this morning we were actually running an exercise for over a company of 1,000 people in London based on simultaneous bombs going off precisely at the railway stations that happened this morning. So I still have the hairs on the back of my neck standing upright.
To get this quite straight, you were running an exercise to see how you would cope with this, and it happened while you were running the exercise?
Precisely. And it was about 9:30 this morning. We'd planned this for a company, and for obvious reasons I don't want to reveal their name, but if they're listening, they'll know it. And we had a room full of crisis managers for the first time they met. And so within 5 minutes, we made a pretty rapid decision. This is the real one. And so we went through the correct drills of activating crisis management procedures to jump from slow time to quick time thinking and so on.
If we use a standard actuary employed by major insurance companies to calculate the probability of these events coinciding in a 10-year mean, we learn that the probability of this happening is greater than 1 in 300 fretagillion. To put that in perspective, that's a number with 41 zeros behind it. That is trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and still more trillions times greater than all the grains of sand in all the world. To put that number in perspective, it has 41 zeros. Scientists using supercomputers have estimated that the Earth has over 7 quintillion grains of sand. A quintillion has 18 zeros.
It would appear as some way of stopping the response of the emergency services or providing some kind of cover for what must be operations orchestrated in some way by the state.
The evidence is overwhelming. All the telltale signs are there of government-sponsored terror. Only the British government had the know-how to carry out the attacks and to control the situation before and after the bombings. And of course, there's all the other admitted cases where the British government has hired terrorists to carry out assassinations or carried out bombings in their own country as a pretext for political control. And then, of course, there's qui bono, Latin for who benefits, who stands to gain. In the weeks leading up to 7/7, Tony Blair's poll numbers had fallen to the lowest point in his 7-year administration. His Labour Party was sure to lose the parliamentary elections. Support for the war was dismal. Despite the bombings, which did improve his approval ratings and support for the war, he was still only barely able to maintain control over the British House of Commons. In the wake of the bombings, Tony Blair's administration descended on the British people with a raft of tyrannical legislation, attacking the press, freedom of assembly, and setting up the conditions needed for a martial law takeover of the nation through the Civil Contingencies Act. And of course, the bombings took place while world leaders were meeting in Scotland, so Bush and Blair could grandstand and blame the whole thing on Iraq, legitimizing their war. Despite the fact that the G8 World Summit was coming to England on July 7th, the British government lowered the terror threat on the London Underground in early June and conveniently lowered security.